Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Since the Trump administration began its immigration crackdown, ICE agents have conducted several raids across the North Country. They've arrested workers at lumber mills, dairy farms, and most recently, over 20 day laborers and restaurant workers in Lake Placid. Local immigration advocates say many of these detainees were ultimately deported. One man who was detained and later released told his story to the New York Public News Network's David Escobar.
On May 28th at 7:25 in the morning, a maintenance worker from Venezuela was walking to his truck outside the Grandview Resort in Lake Placid. We're not identifying him because he fears speaking publicly could jeopardize his political asylum case.
Voy caminando hacia mi camioneta y veo otra camioneta diferente a las que se parquean ahí.
He says he noticed a truck he'd never seen before. It felt out of place.
Y me pareció muy raro, me asusté. Pero dije, no, no creo.
He was scared, but he told himself it couldn't be ICE. As he stepped out of his truck, he says two men emerged from behind the unmarked vehicle, stopped him, and told him to raise his hands. He says his work authorization documents were inside his car.
Yo le comienzo a decir, mi cartera está dentro de la camioneta, ¿la puede revisar?
He says he told the agents his immigration paperwork was inside his truck, but they wouldn't let him get it.
Pero no, tú, you are under arrest. Pusieron las esposas.
Instead, they handcuffed him and told him he was under arrest. After his arrest, the worker says he watched ICE agents round up over a dozen more men, throwing some detainees to the ground. He says he heard men scream for help from inside the vans.
Nos pusieron, nos encadenaron alrededor de la barriga, las piernas como si fuésemos unos criminales.
He says they chained the men's waists and legs, which he says made them feel like criminals. He says the officers were celebrating the fact that they had arrested so many people.
De hecho, hasta celebraban, como que agarraron a, hicieron, como que hicieron su cometido, por decirlo así.
We asked ICE twice about this incident, but they didn't respond. After processing at a local jail, the detainees were taken to the Batavia Detention Center near Buffalo. The worker says the trip took about 12 hours, and he was given only a bottle of water. For 3 days, he wasn't allowed to contact his family. He says he kept wondering whether his wife and children even knew where he was.
Mi esposa creo que cuando se enteró del movimiento en Lake Placid lloró, se tiró al piso porque no, no.
He says his wife cried and collapsed when she learned about the arrests in Lake Placid. Their family knew this could happen, he says, but never thought it would happen to them.
¿Qué va a pasar conmigo?
This Venezuelan man's experience isn't unique. Keila Grimet, who leads the group North Country Immigrant Allies, says they've heard similar accounts from immigrants detained across the region.
The reality is that people are being surveilled, that they are being tracked, that in some situations we're finding out that they've been told by ICE that they were followed for multiple days across multiple towns until they got to a location where ICE could detain them with very little awareness from the community.
Grimet says the agency's tactics have created a climate of fear, especially among Latino immigrants who she says are more likely to be profiled. Grimet says many of the people she's seen detained in Lake Placid have pending asylum cases and no criminal history at all, far different from the Trump administration's repeated claims that ICE is targeting the worst of the worst. That includes this maintenance worker. He says he's never missed an immigration check-in since moving to Lake Placid 2.5 years ago, making it difficult to understand why he was detained.
No tengo ni siquiera multas de tránsito, ni siquiera en mi país ni acá.
He tells me he doesn't even have a traffic ticket. He says when you know you're doing the right thing and working hard for your family and yourself, you're never prepared for something like this to happen to you. Rather than accept voluntary deportation, he fought his case. After 2 weeks in detention, ICE released him on bail, but he now wears an ankle monitor. He says he asked for an alternative but was denied. He says the ankle monitor is uncomfortable, especially because he works outside on his feet all day.
para vestirme, para todo. Entonces,
still, the worker tells me he thanks God for getting him out of detention and back to his family. The arrests have also changed life in Lake Placid beyond those who were detained. Father John Jankovic, a retired priest at St. Agnes Catholic Church, says many immigrant parishioners now keep an even lower profile.
For the last year, they have gone underground, I guess you might say, or certainly have embraced a low profile. I think being out only when it's essential work and that type of thing.
He says that fear has only grown, especially as reports of violent encounters involving ICE have reached smaller communities, including the recent shooting of an immigrant by federal agents in Biddeford, Maine.
I also sense a deeper concern that some of the killings that have taken place by ICE, people wonder, could that happen in a quiet little community like Lake Placid?
About a month after his release, the worker says he's still looking over his shoulder. He says he won't even park in the lot where he was detained. Given his pending asylum case, I ask him why he's willing to tell his story.
No sabemos si para que hagan algo o para estar atento.
He says some locals, even people who were born and raised here, don't understand what ICE is doing in their own community. Whether they choose to act or simply stay informed, he says it's important they understand what's happening. And he says that's exactly why he chose not to stay silent. In Lake Placid, I'm David Escobar for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Patrick Batuello, founder and president of Horse Racing Wrongs, about his concern over the cruelty to horses and the amount of taxpayer dollars being used to promote the industry across the country, but especially in New York State.
To put it simply, horse racing in America is a house of cards. So roughly 75% of all U.S. tracks are being propped up by taxpayer dollars. In New York, which, by the way, is the most subsidized state in the country, that translates to over $250 million annually, almost $4 billion since the subsidies began in 2004. So it is no exaggeration to say that 9 of the 11 current racetracks in New York would have shuttered years ago. And with only Belmont, and it only because of one weekend a year, by the way, the Belmont Stakes weekend, and Saratoga surviving. This is corporate welfare on a shocking scale. It's about $1 billion in total across the country every year. But in New York, it's about a quarter of that on its own.
And yet there's a bit of a caveat here, isn't there? And you've acknowledged this to me over the years, Patrick Batuello, president and founder of Horse Racing Wrongs, the idea that Saratoga is the place, the museum is there. The history of Saratoga is so wrapped up in the horse racing industry. Again, you've acknowledged that it's probably going to survive there.
Yeah, it defines anomaly. So Saratoga Racecourse is probably the preeminent track in the country. It is self-sustaining. So the argument that they need money is absurd on its face. We recognize that. Growing up in this area, I was born and raised in the Capital Region, so I know full well how big a part of the culture, the community Saratoga Racecourse is. It is not just a place for hardened gamblers to go. You do see families. You do see younger people in high school and college, which you don't see at Finger Lakes, which you don't see at a Belmont other than Belmont Stakes Day, or 97% of the other tracks in the country. It's different. It's a social scene as well as a place to gamble. But all the cruelties that exist across the country at every other track exist at the same level at Saratoga Racecourse. And the killing, again, the numbers speak for themselves. Over 250 dead horses at Saratoga since 2009. Saratoga averages 15 kills per summer. Over an eight-week summer meet, about 15 kills. It's almost guaranteed, if you look at the numbers year to year, that 15 horses will die during the course of the meet. Again, that's racing training and stall. We don't differentiate between the three types of deaths. It's just as cruel as Finger Lakes, just as deadly as Finger Lakes, It's just that Saratoga has a whole different marketing scheme and has been successful. And we acknowledge that, as you said.
Now, I do want to say NIRA officials say that they have the health and safety of horses and jockeys as their highest priority. But when you look at what's called the sport of kings, regular folks who show up to watch horse racing, they're often misinformed, think that, we've heard this a lot, Patrick, the horses love to run. They really enjoy this.
Right. They love to run. That's the great irony here. They say that they love to run, and then they stick them in a tiny 12 by 12 box alone, by the way. These are social herd animals for over 23 hours a day. That's love to run. They exhibit the stereotypies and what are called stall vices, things like bobbing, swaying, weaving, cribbing, what's called wind sucking. They'll suck in air. Sometimes they self-mutilate. These are clear, unequivocal signs of mental and emotional duress. And I've been told by countless horse people who've taken horses off the track in their retirement, sometimes these vices never go away. It's profoundly sad, and it's something that most people don't hear about and don't understand fully. The deaths speak for themselves, and when NIRA talks about the welfare of the horse, they're not going to do anything about confinement because that's how you protect your assets, by sticking them in this box. You can't have them out in an open pasture with other horses for fear that they would break a bone or be compromised in some way. They're assets, and that's how they protect them. So that's the worst part of their lives, is the confinement. But there are other things that are just as bad. When you talk about the drugging and the doping, I think people know about that. The whipping. Imagine if you saw someone whipping his dog in the park, you and everyone else around you would call 911, and that person would be arrested on the spot for animal cruelty. In New York, felony animal cruelty. Yet at the racetrack, it's all considered just part of the game, and make no mistake, they're whipping the horses. We've got extensive documentation on that from scientists. It's, of course it hurts. That's why they do it. Run faster or I will hit you. So from start to finish, it's cruelty defined. And again, it's not just about horses dying. It's the everyday abuse. And you mentioned NIRA and the welfare of the horse. I've heard from a lot of racehorse people say, come visit my stable area. We'll show you how pampered these horses are. We hear this all the time. It's all a question of how you define quality of life, right? They define it as the horse is being fed, is being given medical attention, is being protected from the elements and from predators. That to them is a good life. I don't define it a good life that way. That horse is, and I know this is an inflammatory word, but is enslaved. They have lost any autonomy that they were born with. They don't have any agency. They can't be a horse. They're not allowed to be around other horses. Again, stuck in these stalls, solitary confinement. And you mentioned the sport of kings. In what other sport does that apply? In what other sport are the athletes literal chattel? In what other sport are they beaten for motivation? In what other sport are they regularly dying on the playing field? In the 418-year combined history of America's four major sports, baseball, basketball, football, and hockey, there have been three in-game deaths. About that many horses die in U.S. races every single day. So this idea that it's a sport is an obscenity, and it's time that people start looking at it through a clear lens. And for me, the most obvious comparison is dog racing. And when we were up there Sunday, I was holding a sign that showed two greyhounds muzzled and being forced to race, and a racehorse being whipped and being forced to race, with the simple sentence, it's the same thing. It is the exact same thing. In fact, I argue that horse racing is worse because many of these horses, if not most of them, when their careers or so-called careers are over, land in equine hell, the slaughterhouse. That's something that did not exist in dog racing. Dog racing is prohibited on moral grounds in 44 states, including New York. There are just two tracks left in West Virginia, and they're in danger of closing. There was a House-passed Greyhound Protection Act this past April that, if it passes the Senate, it'll eliminate it federally. There'll be no more dog racing in the entire United States. And yet we give horse racing a pass under the banner of sport. It's not rational. I think if you just come to it with a clear mind and an open heart, you'll see it for what it is. And that's our message, David. When we're out there protesting, is especially with the young families coming in, this is the same thing as dog racing. You wouldn't be here if there were whipping dogs to race today. You got to get beyond this, what they used to call it, the August place to be, Saratoga Racecourse. You got to get beyond the marketing and see it for what it is.
That's Patrick Battuello, founder and president of Horse Racing Wrongs. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This month, the MAOPAC, Central School District Board of Education, selected its next president. As the Legislative Gazette's Elias Guerra reports, the trustee's job as a U.S. Immigration Customs and Enforcement agent has split the community.
When news spread in January that a MAOPAC school board member also worked for ICE, most residents attending the meeting gave Christopher Harrigan a standing ovation.
Trustee Harrigan's employment does not disqualify him under New York State law from continuing to serve as a duly elected member of this Board of Education.
Fast forward 6 months, and the board recently voted 5-4 to name Harrigan its president. Residents are divided as ICE activity continues to escalate during the second Trump administration. Earlier this month, ICE officers killed Lorenzo Salgado Araujo as he was driving to a Houston construction job site with three co-workers, including his brother. His family said he was very close to obtaining legal status. The shooting came just days before men in Florida and Maine died in separate incidents that are part of President Donald Trump's federal immigration crackdown, renewing scrutiny of the Department of Homeland Security's law enforcement tactics. Dozens of people have been shot by ICE, according to the New York Times. In the Putnam County School District, many community members still support Harrigan. Don Pizzuto is among them.
So I know for a lot of people, this is a political issue with regards to immigration. For me personally, this is very much not a political issue. This is based on a community member who I've had personal experience with.
Pizzuto said she's lived in MAOPAC since she was 4. She appreciates the job Harrigan has done on the school board, creating activities for kids, like a pickup basketball game during COVID.
I feel like it's not fair to base who Chris is based on just what he does as a job, because I think that's very short-sighted, because people can do all sorts of jobs, and that doesn't necessarily mean that their values are always aligned with what their job is.
But Bela Lamonic, who was born in the community, said she's appalled that the school board voted to make Harrigan president.
I think it's a slap in the face to the community who has expressed really outrage at having an ICE agent on the Board of Education. It's not my job to say, or my prerogative to say, he can't be an ICE agent. If he was hired to be an ICE agent and he is employed, that's on his conscience and in his morality. But to be able to control, I don't know how many millions of dollars the budget of MAOPAC is.
Tanner McCracken is a former school board member. Now he is running for a Putnam County legislature seat. He says Harrigan is an outstanding community member. According to the school district's website, Harrigan is a graduate of SUNY New Paltz who has worked in law enforcement for nearly 20 years and has lived in MAOPAC since 2012. He was elected to the school board in 2024 and his current term runs through June 2027. McCracken said he found out about Harrigan's job at ICE when Harrigan joined the board and said Harrigan has had a calming effect on the board.
In my opinion, the people that oppose Harrigan, this is a political view that they are using the board service as an avenue to have their political views heard. They have an objection to the function of ICE. They disagree with it. And now that they see someone who is an ICE agent serving in a position of public trust, they're just going to use this platform to have their views spoken about. And they're not even, you know, taking into consideration who Chris Harrigan, the person, is. And I think that's actually very unfair.
But Lamonic does not see Harrigan's occupation as promoting safety.
So I think that it could be very dangerous for families and kids within the district, kids' friends within the district, to have someone in so much power who actually, in the end of the day, has total allegiance to an agency that is bent on, as we saw last week, killing three people, that they don't have any scruples as to not endorse this kind of behavior.
And she is not impressed by his leadership qualifications.
Yes, he probably has good leadership abilities, telling his subordinates in ICE to capture people and destroy families.
Pizzuto said Harrigan's job is just a job, and if people only listened more, they might understand where she is coming from.
Sometimes, especially Putnam, because we are a red county, people have like really bad assumptions about what that means. And although we may be Republican, I think most people are more in the middle. And I think personally, just our country, I think we have a lot more in common than we do than we don't. I just think that the way things get addressed is causing division. You know, the media does it. I think social media does it. And if people could just stay focused on the issues and not attack one another, I think we could probably find some middle ground somewhere. But once it gets to personal attacks, people are just gonna, they shut down.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation wants to recruit pheasant hunters to promote preservation. More from the New York Public News Network's Sophia Imbriaco.
Last month, the New York DEC released a strategic plan that, over the next decade, would shift state efforts away from trying to restore wild pheasant habitat and toward recruiting hunters. Jackie Lendrum, director of the state's Division of Fish and Wildlife, explains the DEC is aiming to promote a conservation ethic through hunting.
Once folks are outside and they're experiencing the great outdoors that we have here in New York State, and the wildlife, the habitats, these great state lands, that then they value that, right? If they're out there, they're experiencing it, they value it, they'll work to protect it.
Lendrum says many people getting into hunting are interested in connecting with where their food comes from.
One of the growing populations of new hunters that we're seeing are actually women in their mid to early 30s. And what you're seeing is that people really want to be involved and know where their food is coming from, right? And so there is nothing more natural or more organic than meat that you harvest yourself.
Since the early 20th century, pheasants have been a favorite of small game hunters in New York, and hunting them is an accessible way to get into the sport. However, New York's wild pheasant populations are at an all-time low, as New York DEC biologist and small game unit leader Joshua Stiller explains. This is largely due to habitat loss.
You know, we had a lot of areas of New York that the landscape has just changed significantly. We've lost grasslands. We've lost the habitat that would otherwise support pheasants in New York State.
As pheasant hunting remains popular, the state raises and releases over 30,000 pheasants annually on lands open to the public for hunting. The new pheasant stocking plan would increase the number of stocking locations near major population centers and promote awareness of public pheasant hunting opportunities. The state's DEC is accepting comments on the plan through July 25th. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Sophia Imbriaco.
The Adirondacks are known for their high peaks with panoramic views, but in the foothills of the park, a smaller climb can offer a satisfying payoff from the summit. Emily Russell went for a short hike up Stewart Mountain in the southern Adirondacks and brings us this audio postcard.
So I'm hiking up Stewart Mountain, which is in the southern Adirondacks. It's part of the Chester Challenge, and it's a warm summer day. The sun is leaving these little, like, shifting pockets of light along the trail as I go. Starting to climb a bit. I've been out driving around the southern Adirondacks for work today, and I wanted to stretch my legs at the end of the day, but not do too big of a hike. So I just looked at the map and I saw this on there and it seemed short enough. And so here we are. The forest floor is, it's covered in a lot of dried leaves. from the fall, but there are sprouts of lime green grass popping up. Each strand is, I don't know, 6 to 8 inches tall. And it's just giving the forest floor a bit of brightness all around me. I grew up not too far from here. Every so often we would, as a kid, go hike a little mountain in Warrensburg or Lake George. And so I have a fondness for these smaller Adirondack foothills, like this one, like Stewart Mountain. I'm getting near the summit now and started to hear this swell of, I don't know if they're grasshoppers or another kind of insect that makes that kind of low humming chorus that you hear throughout the summer. Okay, wow. And here we are. Oh, this is amazing. So I'm walking out on this ledge of rock. Wow, it's warm out here in the sun. I can feel it coming up from the rock. And oh, the view is just spectacular. I can see what I believe is Loon Lake. And there's someone water skiing behind a boat out there, a couple other boats. And just beautiful. Emily Russell, North Country Public Radio, on Stewart Mountain in the Southern Adirondacks.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcasts.org. Look for program number 2630. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.